going to start in Joshua chapter 10. We talked last week about how Joshua, even though he was tricked into making a treaty with the Gibeonites, when the Gibeonites were threatened by a confederation of Canaanite kings, Joshua immediately called the armies of Israel to go to their defense. Well, there was something unusual in that battle. And we didn't touch on it last week. We're going to touch on it this week. So we start in Joshua chapter 10. This will kind of set the table here. When Adonizedek, the king of Jerusalem, heard that Joshua had taken Ai and totally destroyed it, doing to Ai and its king what he had done to Jericho and its king, and that the people of Gibeon had made a treaty of peace with Israel and had become their allies, he and his people were very much alarmed at this, because Gibeon was an important city, like one of the royal cities. It was larger than Ai, and all of its men were good fighters. So Adonizedek, the king of Jerusalem, appealed to Hoham, the king of Hebron, Piram, the king of Jarmuth, Japhia, the king of Lachish, and Debir, the king of Eglon. "Come up and help me attack Gibeon," he said, "because it's made peace with Joshua and the Israelites." So the five kings of the Amorites, the kings of Jerusalem, Hebron, Jarmuth, Lachish, and Eglon, joined forces. They moved up with all their troops and took positions against Gibeon and attacked it. The Gibeonites sent word to Joshua in camp at Gilgal, "Do not abandon your servants. Come up to us quickly and save us. Help us, because all the Amorite kings from the hill country have joined forces against us." So Joshua marched up from Gilgal with his entire army, including all the best fighting men. The Lord said to Joshua, "Do not be afraid of them. I've given them into your hand. Not one of them will be able to withstand you." So Joshua makes an effort, and God says that was the thing for you to do, right? Oh, but it gets even better. They didn't take their time and dilly-dally. You read the next verse verse 9, after an all-night march from Gilgal, Joshua took them by surprise. Yeah, I bet he did. There wasn't time for the reinforcements to get there if he was going to come. All right, so Joshua brings them back and says the Lord threw them into confusion before Israel. So Joshua and the Israelites defeated them completely at Gibeon. Israel pursued them along the road going up to Beth Horon and cut them down all the way to Azekah and Makeda. As they fled before Israel on the road from Beth Horon to Azekah, the Lord hurled large hailstones down on them, and more of them died from the hail than were killed by the swords of the Israelites. Well, you want some confirmation that God's on your side? When he starts beating your enemies to death with hailstones. On this day, the Lord gave the Amorites over to Israel, and Joshua said to the Lord in the presence of Israel, "Sun, stand still over Gibeon, and you, moon, over the valley of Ajalon." So the sun stood still, and the moon stopped till the nation avenged itself on its enemies, as it is written in the book of Jasher. The sun stopped in the middle of the sky and delayed going down about a full day. There's never been a day like it before or since, a day when the Lord listened to a human being. Surely the Lord was fighting for Israel. Then Joshua returned with all Israel to the camp at Gilgal. Now, again, you want a confirmation that you're doing what God wants you to do? Hey, God, I'm not through wiping out all of our enemies yet. Why don't you just stop the sun in the sky and leave me enough daylight to finish the job? And he does it. Absolutely, against all laws of physics, that can't happen, right? Unless you're the one who ordered the universe, then I suppose it can happen. But this is an incredible thing that says that what they were doing was what God wanted them to do. Now, I'll give you the Reader's Digest version of the rest of the story. The five Amorite kings that all got together and said, "Let's get our troops and go wipe these folks out," they ran and hid. They ran and hid in a cave. Israel found them. rolled a stone in front of the cave until the army could come up and they could summarily dispatch those five kings. You know, you make an alliance against Israel, you better be careful. God fights for them. And in this case, this whole incident confirms that the conquest of Canaan is in his plan. So what happens after that? Well, the rest is chapter 10. If you remember how Israel is laid out, I'm looking at it from my standpoint, it'll be backwards to you. But Jerusalem and Jericho and what have you, kind of in the middle of the nation. All right? And the rest of chapter 10 talks about the southern cities being conquered. So basically, Joshua takes the Israelite army and does a southern sweep and basically takes control of the part of Israel that's down toward Egypt and basically takes over virtually all of it. So that's the rest of chapter 10, which we're not going to go into in any great detail. We go over into chapter 11, we find out he does the same thing in the north, up towards Syria. He does a loop in the north and captures many cities there. Okay, we get over into 11, about verse 16. It says, Joshua took this entire land, the hill country, all the Negev, the whole region of Goshen, the western foothills, the Arabah, and the mountains of Israel and their foothills, from the Mount of Halak, which arises towards Seir, to Baal Gad in the valley of Lebanon below Mount Hermon. He captured all the kings and put them to death. Joshua waged war against all these kings for a long time, except for the Hivites living in Gibeon. Not one city made a treaty of peace with the Israelites, who took them all in battle. Okay. Let's see, we come on down into verse 21. At that time, Joshua went and destroyed the Anakites from the hill country, from Hebron and Debir and Anab, from all the hill country of Judah. No Anakites were left in Israel territory. Only in Gaza, Gath, and Ashdod did any survive. Any of that sound familiar? Gaza, Gath, and Ashdod. Still a pain in their side. Gaza, Ashdod, Gath, Ekron, and I'm drawing a blank on the last one, are the five cities of the Philistines. We're going to hear a whole lot more about the Philistines, you know, when you get into Kings and Chronicles and what have you. Even in Samuel, we hear a lot about the Philistines. Well, those are the five cities of the Philistines.
You still hear about them today.
Well, the entire reason that the world calls that region Palestine is the Romans named it after the Philistines to thumb their nose at Israel. They renamed Jerusalem Aeolia Capitolina and the entire land of Judah, Palestine.
But there is a spot in there where it says Gaza too.
Mm-hmm. The Gaza Strip right now is a hotbed. It's not going to be long, I'm afraid, before the IDF loads up the tanks and goes over there and cleans house. But that's probably going to happen.
Pretty quick.
The Anakim, you know, it talks about these being the NIV calls them Anakites, Complete Jewish Bible calls them Anakim. The people of Anak. Okay? Well, what do we know about the people of Anak? Anak was a giant. What else do we know about the city of Gath? One of these cities we talked about. Who do we know, a famous individual that's from Gath? Goliath. Goliath. Yeah, Goliath is from Gath. He is a one of the Anakim. Yeah, he was what, 9 feet tall? So, you see, when you don't finish the job,
come back to haunt you.
sometimes it comes back to haunt you. It came back to haunt Israel in the days of Goliath. It came back to haunt Israel in all the days of David when they warred and battled with the Philistines. And that piece of property that was never really conquered by Israel is still a thorn in their side today. That is the home of the most radical of the Palestinian groups, Hamas, which is a terrorist organization regardless of what the UN says. Somebody shoots rockets at population centers is a terrorist organization. Not much way around that. Okay, so the book of Joshua then goes into kind of a summary. The entirety of Joshua chapter 12 is a list of the kings that were conquered. First by Moses, the few on the other side of the river, and then all the kings, the 31 kings that Joshua and the armies of Israel conquered. It's, hey, let me just remind you how big a deal this is. You know, 31 kings and their territories were taken over during the war under Joshua. But then we get over to Joshua 13 and we find a problem. In the first seven verses of Joshua 13, when Joshua had grown old, the Lord said to him, "You're now very old, and there are still very large areas of land to be taken over. This is the land that remains, all the regions of the Philistines and the Geshurites from the Shihor River on the east of Egypt to the territory of Ekron on the north, all of it counted as Canaanite, though held by the five Philistine rulers in Gaza, Ashdod, Ashkelon, Gath, and Ekron. The territory of the Avites on the south, and all the land of the Canaanites from Era of the Sidonians as far as Aphek on the border of the Amorites. The area of Byblos, all of Lebanon to the east, from Baal Gad below Mount Hermon to Lebo Hamath. As for all the inhabitants of the mountain regions from Lebanon to Mishperoth Maim, that is all the Sidonians, I myself will drive them out before the Israelites. Be sure to allocate this land to Israel for an inheritance as I've instructed you, and divide it as an inheritance among the nine tribes and the half tribe of Manasseh." So that's a pretty lengthy list. The job wasn't done. Joshua was at the end of his road, and there were still large areas that were unconquered. As I said, you know, many of those, you know, the entire Gaza Strip is one of them. Part of this in the north, it talks about the area of Byblos, all Lebanon to the east. Well, there's still a thorn in their flesh, isn't it? Okay? So there's a vast amount of territory that was not taken. So then we go off, and I'm not going to bore you with the division of the land. It's a part of the hardest part of the Bible to read unless you're an Israelite who or a Jew who has family ties and knows that I'm of the tribe of Benjamin. What land was given to my tribe? You know, that becomes exciting. But to most of us, it's pretty meaningless because we don't know what the names of these cities are or whatever. But we go from Joshua 13:8 all the way down through the rest of 13, and it talks about dividing the land on the other side of Jordan. Remember, you got 2.5 tribes that Moses gave an inheritance to over there. Well, this established the borders of what they controlled on the east bank of the Jordan River. Okay? We go into 14, and the land, there's a general talk conversation about the land on the west being divided, but doesn't go into great detail until you get down to verse 6. Joel referred to this in his sermon, talking about Caleb. Joshua 14:6 talks about the allotment for Caleb. And remember, Caleb was one of the two that brought back the good report, right? So he was a man that was a man of faith and what have you. And he wanted to do things the way that God wanted him to do. So we find here it says, "Now the people of Judah approached Joshua at Gilgal, And Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, the Kenizzite, said to him, "You know what the Lord said to Moses, the man of God, at Kadesh Barnea about you and me. I was 40 years old when Moses, the servant of the Lord, sent me from Kadesh Barnea to explore the land. And I brought him back a report according to my convictions. But my fellow Israelites who went up with me made the hearts of the people melt in fear. I, however, followed the Lord my God wholeheartedly. So on that day Moses swore to me, 'The land on which your feet have walked will be your inheritance and that of your children forever, because you have followed the Lord my God wholeheartedly.' Now then, just as the Lord promised, as he has kept me alive for 45 years since the time he said this to Moses," so he's how old?
85.
Okay. "So here I am today, 85 years old. I'm still as strong today as I was the day Moses sent me out." Wouldn't that be good? Okay. "Now give me this hill country that the Lord promised me that day. You yourself have heard then that the Anakites were there and their cities were large and fortified. But the Lord helping me, I will drive them out," just as he said. He's not wanting to move to the garden spot. He's wanting to go where the Anakites are. The giants. He wants to go to the toughest part that he can go and go do what he's called to do at 85. How many of us would want to do that? "Then Joshua blessed Caleb, son of Jephunneh, and gave him Hebron as his inheritance. So Hebron has belonged to Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, and the Kenizzite ever since, because he followed the Lord, the God of Israel, wholeheartedly. Hebron used to be called Kiriath Arba, after Arba, who was the greatest man among the Anakites. And then the land rested from war." Zeal for God should not grow tired or old. And I look at myself and I think about, you know, my energy level and what have you, and I sit here thinking, "Lord, you know, I've coasted a long time. And now I'm pushing 60, a few months ago. I've caught it now." "And you're calling me deeper than I've ever been before. Are you sure about this? Are you sure about this?" And he won't let me quit, so I guess I'm going to keep doing it. But our zeal, you see, you know, let's think about this picture. Here's Caleb. He's 40 years old. He goes and explores the land. The people won't accept the good report. They only accept the bad report. So it's going to be 40 years in the desert. He spends 40 years walking around in circles while the people who said, "No, we can't do it," die off. And now he's 80. And they're going to move into the land. And apparently we've got about 5 years of time that expire right here, you know, up until this point. They had largely conquered the land, and Joshua's dividing it up. It's been another 5 years of war. 5 years of war in the year 2018 is one thing. 5 years of war in 1400 BC is something else entirely. You walked everywhere you went. You fought with not with rifles, but with swords and spears.
Big rocks.
Big rocks, whatever. Let's say it was physical. And let's say it was up close and personal. You know, never having been in the military, I figure it's one thing to take a man's life at 100 yards with a rifle. And it's a whole different thing to run him through with a sword up close and personal. Have to be rough. Have to be difficult. So Caleb had every right to say, "Give me a place with a lake and a pasture and an olive grove and a vineyard, and I'm going to sit down and prop my feet up." I remember what Moses told me. "Give me that land. Yeah, I know there's giants on it. Give it to me anyway. God said he's going to run them out. He'll run them out." Same man that he was 45 years before. The same thing. Connie?
Well, energy. And as long as you keep the passionate, you keep wanting to go on. And when it dies, you don't care if you go on or not. So you've got to try to keep it.
Let's bring that into the New Testament for a minute. Jesus said, I come to give you life and life abundantly. What's abundant life? Is that a quantity of life or is that a quality of life? In this body, it's a quality of life, right? And your quality of life is measured by your level of contentment and whether or not you feel like what you do has meaning and whether or not you can see some fruits of your labor that are, you know, that are positive, you know, things that you're accomplishing. And Caleb had abundant life. There's a phrase that they use in the Old Testament when someone that was a saint of God passes away, that he goes to rest with his father, old and full of years. I've always interpreted that this way. That means that his life was done in such a way that he was content with it. It was packed with experiences. It was packed with successes. It was packed with laughter and tears. See, in Jewish philosophy, those opposites always must balance each other. In a joyful time, you remember that there are times when you'll cry. At a time when you're crying, you remember that there will be times that you have laughed and will laugh again. That balance of life, you know, you don't appreciate the laughter if you've never had the tears. If you've never had the laughter and all you've had was tears, how can you possibly anticipate what it would be like? If all you've had was laughter and never a tear, how can you appreciate the joy of the laughter, unless you have something to compare it to, contrast it against? So that whole mindset is, the Bible's full of that mindset. You know, you've got to be able to see that to appreciate this. Okay? So Caleb gets this great inheritance. Then we go off into chapters 15, 16 and 17 and 18 and 19, which is all about this tribe gets these cities and it goes to that river and it goes to this coastline. Okay? Not central to our discussion, but I do want you to understand this. Who did the land of Canaan belong to? And when he said, this is yours for your tribe, for its inheritance forever, what does that mean?
It belonged to your tribe.
You get to use it. It's still God's land. But you get to occupy it, you and your people, forever. It's yours. What happens if you get poor and sell it? That's why the Shemitah year comes around. That's why the Jubilee year comes around, people to be restored to their inheritance. And there's another theme that's also throughout the Old Testament is don't move the ancient boundary stone. Well, that sounds interesting. What does that mean? That means that God divided this land up, and if you would imagine, you know, if anybody's ever done any surveying or gone around an old piece of property or gone to a cemetery where they've got the little circle thing in the corner of the plot that's got your initial family initials in it, that's a boundary stone. Okay? You know, in the old days, they would actually put a stone monument at the corners of the property. And if I go over to Ray's property and move his boundary stone, what have I done? There'd probably be a shooting war, but, you know, yeah, effectively it's a theft, right? But it's even more so in Israel because God established the boundaries. God said the ancient boundary stone goes right here. That means it doesn't go over here, right? He gets to say where the boundaries are. Now, that'll preach for about a week and a half in the New Testament. And I will tell you, the modern church has moved so many ancient boundary stones, it's barely recognizable as the church anymore. That's also another message. Joshua 20 is all about cities of refuge. Now, what's that all about? If I accidentally kill somebody, I can run to a city of refuge. And that person that I killed that was in Ray's family, and he is the avenger of blood who wants to kill me for that murder, or that manslaughter, or whatever you call it, he can't come and get me there because I'm in a safe place. Now, if it was a premeditated murder, they'll drag me out of there. But if, you know, we were fooling around, he fell off the donkey and broke his neck, I can go to that safe place and hide. Okay? Those things are all important issues, and they spread those around. I understand, you know. Think about, it's a sanctuary city. Lord, I can't go there. That's, wait a minute, that's Indiana. Indiana wants me. No, I can't go to the back. Yeah, that's entirely different. But cities of refuge were established and scattered all around the land so that there was one convenient enough that if you found yourself in that situation, you could be safe from the avenger of blood. Okay? We jump into 21. And the first 42 verses are all cities for the Levites. Remember, the Levites were the sons of Levi, right? And they were one of the tribes of Israel, but they inherited no land because their job was what?
Preach.
To take care of the temple. They did all the manual labor. They did the singing and the playing of instruments and the taking care of all the ashes and all the physical things that it took for tabernacle and later temple worship. The Levites were in charge of. During the time of the tabernacle, okay, Floyd, your family gets to carry all the posts for the curtain that goes around the outside of the tabernacle. That's your job. Every time we move, that's what your family does. You know, Carlos, you get to carry the curtain for the gate. You know, and they divided it up in clans and families like that. But the purpose of the Levites was to be, for want of a better term, the deacons of the Jewish religion. They did the physical things. They did the service things. So they got no land as inheritance, but they did get cities. And those cities were supported by offerings to the temple. They got to have, you know, they could raise some crops and do their things and what have you too, but they were supported by offerings to the temple. Okay? So they got cities assigned. Again, they're scattered out all over Israel so that there's a man of God somewhere around you, any, regardless of where you were. Okay? Let me see. I want to look at this scripture here that I scribbled down and see if I want to share it. Yeah, 21:43-45. So the Lord gave Israel all the land that he had sworn to give their ancestors, and they took possession of it and settled there. The Lord gave them rest on every side, just as he had sworn to their ancestors. Not one of their enemies withstood them. The Lord gave all their enemies into their hands. Not one of all the Lord's good promises to Israel failed. Every one was fulfilled. Okay. So we got a closure here. Remember back in the beginning of all this that the 2.5 tribes that had their inheritance on the east side of the Jordan River had to go with the army and fight in the front because they'd already received their inheritance and they needed to help the rest of their brothers go. Well, as we get into Joshua chapter 22, the first 9 verses say, hey guys, thanks for your service. You can go home to your families now. We've kind of finished what we're doing here. Y'all can go home. Okay? And that's a good thing. But then a colossal misunderstanding happens. Okay? So in Joshua 22, starting at verse 10, actually I'm going to back up into 9. So the Reubenites, the Gadites, and the half-tribe of Manasseh left the Israelites at Shiloh in Canaan and returned to Gilead, their own land, which they had acquired in accordance with the command of the Lord through Moses. When they came to Gelioth near the Jordan in the land of Canaan, the Reubenites, the Gadites, and the half-tribe of Manasseh built an imposing altar there by Jordan. And when the Israelites heard that they had built the altar on the border of Canaan and Gelioth near the Jordan River on the Israelite side, the whole assembly of Israel gathered at Shiloh to go to war against them. Now, what are they thinking? They're setting themselves up as an independent. Yeah. They built an altar to God, and they're not Levites, they're not priests, they're not Joshua. Who are they to build an altar to God? There's only one place to build an altar to God, and they don't even know where that is yet, but they've got a traveling one they use. In the mind of some of the Israelites, what they saw was an act of rebellion. Not a bunch of people that wanted to build a memorial to God. But they thought, they looked at it and said, well, they're building their own temple. They're building an old place to sacrifice. They're going to do their own sacrifices, but they're not Levites. They're not priests. They're not entitled to do that. We got a problem here. So they mount the army to go against them. So the Israelites sent Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the priest, to the land of Gilead, to Reuben, Gad, and the half-tribe of Manasseh. With him they sent 10 of the chief men, one from each of the tribes of Israel, at the head of a family division among the Israelite clans. When they went to Gilead, to Reuben, to Gad, and the half-tribe of Manasseh, they said to them, the whole assembly of Israel says, how could you break faith with the God of Israel like this? How could you turn away from the Lord and build yourselves an altar in rebellion against him now? Was it not the sin of Peor enough for us? Up to this very day we've not cleansed ourselves from that sin, even though a plague fell on the community of Israel, and now you're turning away from the Lord. If you rebel against the Lord today, tomorrow he'll be angry with the whole community of Israel. If the land you possess is defiled, come over to the Lord's land where the Lord's tabernacle stands and share the land with us, but do not rebel against the Lord or against us by building an altar for yourselves other than the altar of the Lord our God. Made a pretty good argument, didn't they? You know, this is what we're seeing here, okay? When Achan, the son of Zerah, was unfaithful in regard to the devoted things, did not wrath come on the whole community? He was not the only one who died for his sin. Basically, if y'all do this, it's going to be bad for all of us. Don't do it or we'll stop you. Then Reuben, Gad, and the half-tribe of Manasseh replied to the heads of the clans of Israel, the mighty one, God the Lord, he knows, and let Israel know, if this has been in rebellion or disobedience to the Lord, do not spare us this day. Hey, y'all got it wrong, okay? And if we've done it out of rebellion, go ahead and kill us. If we've built our own altar to turn away from the Lord and to offer burnt offerings and grain offerings or to sacrifice fellowship offerings on it, may the Lord himself call us to account. No, we did it for fear that someday your descendants might say to ours, what do you have to do with the Lord, the God of Israel? The Lord's made Jordan a boundary between us and you, you Reubenites and Gadites. You have no share in the Lord, so your descendants might cause ours to stop fearing the Lord. This is why we said, let us get ready and build an altar, not for burnt offerings or sacrifices. On the contrary, it's to be a witness between us and you and the generations that follow, that we will worship the Lord at his sanctuary with our burnt offerings, sacrifices, and fellowship offerings. Then in the future, your descendants will not be able to say to ours, you have no share in the Lord. So what are they saying? Look, you know, we've got a natural boundary between us here. And all you guys, you've got the altar to God, and you're doing all the worship stuff over there, and we're over here on the other side of the river, and we're afraid that down the road, a few decades, somebody's going to look and say, what share do they have in Israel? They live on that side of the river. So they built an altar not to do sacrifices on, but as a witness, as a memorial, to say, hey, we're the same people. It's us. You know, look at that and remember that, you know, we all worship the same God. So it's an interesting story here. And we said, if they ever say to us or our descendants, we'll answer, look at the replica of the Lord's altar, which our ancestors built, not for burnt offerings and sacrifices, but as a witness between us and you. Okay? What do we do for memorials? What do we do to remember things?
We put markers up.
Put markers up. What else do we do?
Flowers. And
okay.
Like go to your family's gravestones and put flowers on them. Or
go and look and remember.
Yeah.
Which causes you to recall and make mention of, right? We journal. We write things down. We take photographs. They're all digital now. They're nothing. Does anybody develop film anymore? We do lots of things to remember. You know, if you're married and you wear a wedding ring, that's a memorial. You know, I can't with my knuckles right now. We do lots of things to remember. And this was set up as a memorial. And the idea they very clearly stated there is, hey, look, they built a memorial to God over here. Not to sacrifice on, but to remind us that we're all one people. We all worship the same God. When Phinehas, the priest, and the leaders of the community, the heads of the clans of the Israelites, heard what Reuben, Gad, and Manasseh had to say, they were pleased. And Phinehas, son of Eleazar, the priest, said to Reuben and Gad and Manasseh, today we know that the Lord is with us because you have not been unfaithful to the Lord in this matter. Now you have rescued Israelites from the Lord's hand. And basically, that delegation went back to the other side of the river and said, hey, it's cool. I kind of like what they're doing. They're trying to remember and show that we're all together. Okay. Sometimes what someone does appears to us to be one thing when it's really something else. It would do us well to remember that. We're very quick to either rush to judgment or to turn our back and ignore a situation. And neither one is right. Let's suppose that the Israelites on the west side saw them building that altar and just sat on it and fumed and steamed and talked about it and tweeted about it and posted on Facebook about it without ever going and asking the question. What do you suppose would have happened? You think it could have been saved? It would have been a war. Because feelings would have been hurt. Opinions would have been swayed. Nobody knew the facts. They just knew what it appeared to be. And we all know if it's on the internet, it's true. Right? You know, we all know if you stand and talk about it by the well while you're watering your camel, it's got to be true. You know, there's no such a thing as gossip or misinterpretation. But you see, what happened here is they got their heads together. They constructed a delegation with leading people and godly people and said, go find out what the deal is. And they went over and they had a conversation and they found out that it was not what it appeared to be. And resolution was had. If they had gone and found out that it was what it appeared to be, then I suppose a different kind of resolution would have been had. But here's the thing, you know, we need to remember not to rush to judgment, not to turn a blind eye, and not to take things on the surface, but to look below them to see if it's really what it seems to be. The church above all people should do that. Because after all, at the end of the day, it's about people. It's about people and their soul. It's about a relationship with God. And if we do a lot of judging on what the surface seems, we're going to make a lot of mistakes. We're going to hurt people. We're going to run people off. In this case, people would have died. Well, people may spiritually die because of our judgments. We can't let that happen. We got to remember that people are people and sin, sin. And just because a person sins doesn't make them a bad person. We got to remember that we haven't walked a mile in their shoes or sat in their seat and looked at the world through their lens. And maybe we don't understand. But we need to learn. We need to learn to understand. We need to be, blessed are the peacemakers, they'll be called the children of God. Joshua, chapter 23, is his farewell address. And basically, he calls all the leaders together and he rehearses for them, very much like Moses did at the end of his life. He said, hey, I want you all to remember who you are, where you came from, why you're in the situation you're in today, and it's all God. Okay? Joshua does the same thing. Summoned all Israel, their elders, leaders, judges, and officials, and said to them, I'm very old. You yourselves have seen everything the Lord your God has done to all these nations for your sake. It was the Lord your God who fought for you. Remember how I have allotted as an inheritance for your tribes all the land of the nations that remain, the nations I conquered between the Jordan and the Mediterranean Sea in the west. The Lord your God himself will push them out for your sake. He'll drive them out before you, and you will take possession of their land as the Lord your God promised. He said, hey, it may not all be manifest yet, but the title deed's signed. It's yours. When you're able to possess it, God will help you possess it. Okay? Be very strong. Boy, that we go right back to Joshua chapter 1. Again. Be very strong. That's what God said to him. Be careful to obey all that's written in the book of the law of Moses without turning aside from the right to the left. We are here roughly 70 years later from Joshua chapter 1. And, I'm sorry, 30 years later from Joshua chapter 1. And Joshua was saying to the people the same thing that was said to him. Okay. Be strong, be careful to obey the law, don't turn aside to the right or the left. Don't associate with these nations that remain among you. Do not invoke the names of their gods or swear by them. You must not serve them or bow down to them, but you're to hold fast to the Lord your God as you've done until now. The Lord's driven out from before you great and powerful nations. To this day, no one's been able to withstand you. One of you routs 1,000 because the Lord your God fights for you just as he promised. So be careful to love the Lord your God. What made them strong and successful? Their relationship with God. Without that, they were just human beings. With it, God fought for them. Okay? It's all about the relationship. But if you turn away and ally yourselves with the survivors of these nations that remain among you, and if you intermarry with them and associate with them, then you may be sure that the Lord your God will no longer drive out these nations before you. Instead, they will become snares and traps for you, whips on your backs and thorns in your eyes until you perish from this good land which the Lord your God has given you. Well, that's fatalistic. But it happened. It's the very thing, as we read the Old Testament, as we read the history of the land of Israel, they associated with the Canaanites that were remaining around them. They corrupted them. They caused them to stumble and fall. God sent judgment. They repented. Everything was good for a while. They went right back to what they were doing. God sent judgment. They repented. Everything was good for a while. Oh, that's the book of Judges, isn't it? You know? We're doing real good. We forget God. We start hobnobbing with the Canaanites. And maybe we make a sacrifice to their God just in case that there's something to that. And next thing you know, our enemies are beating on us. Oh God, where are you? Save us. Deliver us. Send us a deliverer. Well, okay, I'll send you a deliverer. And for the life of that person, everything goes real good. And as soon as they die, right back in the same cycle again. Roller coaster ride. God, through Joshua, said it was going to happen. And eventually they were run out of the land. Now I'm about to go the way of all the earth. You know with all your heart and soul that not one of the good promises the Lord your God gave you has failed. Every promise has been fulfilled, not one's failed, but just as all the good things the Lord your God's promised you have come to you, so he will bring on you all the evil things he's threatened, until the Lord your God has destroyed you from this good land he's given you, if you violate the covenant of the Lord your God, which he commanded to you, and go and serve other gods and bow down to them. The Lord's anger will burn against you, and you will quickly perish from the good land he's given you. Certain things are blessed, certain things are cursed. When you choose to walk in blessing, when you choose to be obedient to the principles of God, you'll walk in blessing. When you go the other way, you will just as surely walk in an area that's been cursed. And it may seem good, it may seem pleasant, it may seem profitable. But at the end of the day, there's a payday. And that payday may not be the way you want it to happen. So, you know, there's a way that seemeth good to the man, and the end thereof is destruction. I may have misquoted that slightly, but not much. I got the principle of it, right? So Joshua reminds them of the way of blessing and the way of cursing and how God has come through for them up until this point. Then he is in 24, he says, he assembled all the tribes of Israel at Shechem, said to the people, this is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. Long ago your ancestors, including Terah, the father of Abraham, and Nahor, lived beyond the Euphrates and worshipped other gods. And he goes on and recites to them in 24 the entire history of the Israelite nation, from the call of Abraham all the way through to the conquest of Canaan, and reminds them that it's God that did it. He comes down to verse 14. He says, now fear the Lord and serve him with all faithfulness. Throw away the gods your ancestors worshipped beyond the Euphrates and in Egypt and serve the Lord. But if serving the Lord seems undesirable to you, then choose for yourselves this day whom you will serve, whether the gods of your ancestors served beyond the Euphrates or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you're living. But as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. It's Joshua. Then the people answer, far be it from us to forsake the Lord and serve other gods. It was the Lord our God himself who brought us and our parents up out of Egypt from that land of slavery and performed those great signs before our eyes. He protected us on our entire journey and among all the nations through which we traveled. And the Lord drove out before us those nations, including the Amorites who lived in this land. We too will serve the Lord because he's our God. Sounds like the emotion of the moment was running high. Yeah, I'll do it. Joshua said to the people, you're not able to serve the Lord. He's a holy God. He's a jealous God. He will not forgive your rebellion and your sin. If you forsake the Lord and serve foreign gods, he'll turn and bring disaster on you and make an end of you after he's been good to you. But the people said to Joshua, no, we'll serve the Lord. And Joshua said, you're witnesses against yourselves that this day you've chosen to serve the Lord. They said, yes, we're witnesses. Now then, throw away the foreign gods that are among you and yield your hearts to the Lord, the God of Israel. And the people said to Joshua, we will serve the Lord our God and obey him. On that day, Joshua made a covenant for the people, and there at Shechem he reaffirmed for them the decrees and laws. And Joshua recorded these things in the book of the law of God. Then he took a large stone and set it up under the oak near the holy place of the Lord. See, he said to the people, this stone shall be a witness against us. It has heard all the words the Lord has said to us. It will be a witness against you if you are untrue to your God. Then Joshua dismissed the people, each to his own inheritance. Covenant is an important concept, not just in the Old Testament, but for us today. A covenant is a God-witnessed, I hate to use the word contract, but it's the closest thing I can describe it as. Covenant is said, we are pledged to each other. Marriage is a covenant. You stand before God and before people and you make vows. That creates a covenant. You exchange something of value. Okay? It makes it a covenant. All of God's dealings with mankind are framed in covenants. I commit to this, you commit to that. The thing about these covenants is, unlike our contracts today, we can't negotiate terms. God negotiates the terms. You accept or reject the covenant that God offers you. But the purpose of a covenant is to hold you faithful when you might be weak. The purpose of a covenant of marriage is to, you know, well, that girl over there who's not my wife might be pretty, but I made a commitment before God and people and to her, and therefore I cannot cross that line. A covenant to be a church member might cause you, when you're sitting at home and you really just don't feel like going, to get up and get out and get dressed, maybe get dressed before you get out, and go church. A covenant as a church member might cause you to come out on Tuesday and fight the madding crowd over here when you're giving out food boxes. Or to teach a class. Or to pick up the phone when somebody crosses your heart and say, hey sis, I haven't seen you in a while. How you doing? Is there anything we can do for you? That's what a covenant does. And it's been said, not biblically, but it's been said in society, that a promise made in public will hold you in the place where you're in secret. So, you know, when an opportunity comes that nobody will know about, but I made a promise, I made a vow, God knows, therefore I shall not do this thing, or I shall do this thing, depending on what it may be. Covenant's important. Moses had the people make covenant before they entered into the promised land. At the conclusion of the conquest of the promised land, Joshua had him reaffirm the covenant. It's good to recall and make mention of it. And you know what happened to both of them? They rehearsed the history of their people and they read the book of the law. So just want you to know what you're committing to. This is, okay, God created you, God sustained you, God called you out of all the people in the world, God took care of you when you were in a foreign land as slaves, God brought you out with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm, God gave you the inheritance of this good land. He has a claim on you, human being. It's good for you if you recognize that and reciprocate by giving yourself to him. The book of Joshua ends with the death of Joshua. He died at 110. Let's think about his life for a minute. He was 40 years old when he was sent to explore the land. The report was rejected. You know, he and Caleb were together, right? 40 years later, he and Caleb are the only survivors that get to go into the land. In the next 30 years, Joshua is the leader. And he dies at 110. You know, it almost parallels Moses. Moses was in the courts of Egypt until he was 40. He was on the backside of the desert tending sheep until until he was 80, when he was called to go see Pharaoh. And then he spent the next 40 years wandering around the backside of the desert with the most disgruntled congregation that the world has ever seen. Joshua, 10 years short, but it's the same pattern. 40 was a milestone. 80 was a milestone. I just leave that for you to mull about, but 40 is typically thought of as a generation, by the way, biblically speaking, when you start talking about biblical numerology. The theme of this series on Joshua was possessing the land, and I hope we've learned a little something about what it takes to come into our inheritance. The Israelites came into their inheritance here. They possessed God's promises, and in their case, the promise was primarily the land. We possess God's promises in exactly the same way. The lessons that Joshua learned about being strong and courageous and edifying yourself and building yourself up and believing God, and all of the missteps that we saw about how you got to remember to go check with God for every decision, whether it's going to attack the little town of Ai or whether it's entering into a treaty with the Gibeonites. You know, let's say, what does God have to say about this? Might I check with him before I make this decision? Oh, sign here. Wait a minute. Let me pray first. If we want to successfully possess God's promises, we've got to have that mindset. We've got to think like Joshua thought. We've got to learn the lessons that he so perfectly portrayed and lived out for us. We saw what happened when he did right. We saw what happened when he did wrong. We saw what happened when he entered into a bad deal but had to fulfill it anyway because he'd made a vow. He'd made a covenant. So, you know, all of those things are part and parcel of who we want to be. And if we want to be successful in Christ in this life, we need to learn the lessons of Joshua. Questions, comments?
Yeah, I got a comment. When you were talking about Joshua, I was looking in my study guide. It really went along with what you were saying there. You know, the retaining and everything.
Yep.
It said enter the promised land, and then the conquering of the promised land and distributing portions of the promised land, retaining the promised land 23-24, and then the postscript. But my question is, how did he, I know God told him how to do it, but when he was getting ready to go, did Caleb, did God tell Caleb, look, Joshua's on his way?
Good question. You know, God reveals himself to us in many ways. Sometimes, and this sounds like a cop-out, sometimes you just know. Sometimes you just know what God's saying to you. I think that's his spirit bearing witness with yours. Sometimes he may use someone who delivers the word. He may use a word from a Joshua or a Pastor Joel or a John. Sometimes he may use a word from Mary. You know, those are the ones that hurt. When your kids and your wife straighten you out in God. But here's the thing, you know, we just need to be sensitive enough to know his voice and his character and what his word says, because those are the filters that we've got to judge with. When we get an urge to do something, is it consistent with what we know about the character of God? Is it consistent with the Word of God? Does it stand against the things that Jesus taught? You know, those are your filters, and that's how you judge. And sometimes you just got to pray about it and just kind of set it on the shelf a little bit and say, you know what, God, if that's you, confirm it. And I can't tell you how many times out of the clear blue sky, somebody that had no knowledge of what I was going through has said an offhand comment that either confirmed or blew up what I thought was God's voice. You know, so you know it's amazing how that works. But God, you know, ask God for confirmation. Remember the story of Gideon? You know, now, if you really want me to do this, give me a wet fleece on dry ground. Well, you did that. Oh, well, give me a dry fleece on wet ground.
Yeah.
You know. So, you know.
Yeah.
I said, you know, Lord, you know, one of those 8-foot by 20-foot billboards with flashing neon lights and some lights on it, you know. John
yeah.
C. Kidwell. Do this. You know. Wouldn't life be easier? You know? All right. Be blessed. See y'all Sunday.